This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to The Big Picture for this week. You know, in the second quarter of last year, the economy grew 3.9%. These are numbers that just came out last Friday. In the third quarter of last year, it dropped to below 2%. And by the time we got to the fourth quarter, growth dropped below 1.4%. And now here we are. We've come through the first quarter of 2016, and it dropped 0.5%. As I said, those figures came out last Friday. You know, Jim, we've been talking about the onset of a recession, and we're going to entitle this section, which is really close to my heart as a pilot, Stall Speed. Has economy peaked? And where are we headed? If so, what's the current trend in the GDP? And I don't know, where do we go from here on this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this all began, John, in roughly May of 2013. That's when Bernanke first said, hey, you know, all this money we're printing, we're thinking of stopping it. And it's amazing because quantitative easing stopped in the fourth quarter of 2014. And that's when the economy peaked. In the second quarter of 2014, the economy was growing at an annual rate of 4.5%. In the third quarter of 2014, we were still growing at that 4% rate. The Fed stops its liquidity injections. And John, we've been at lower rates of growth. In fact, we only had one quarter. We had one little bump last year in the second quarter where we got just not quite enough. We got up to 3.8% on the economic growth rate. But I mean, if you take a look at 2013, 2014, and also if you go back to the Fed's quantitative easing programs in 2011, where everything, when you got to the fall of 2011, now folks, remember everything that was happening in 2011. We had Fukushima. We had the Arab Spring. Oil prices spiked. I think WTI got over $110 a barrel. Commodity prices were rising. We had the debt ceiling debate. We had the pig crisis. And I can remember our own recession index got well above 20. The financial stress index got up. The LEIs rolled over. The ISMs. PMIs, everything was a negative territory. I mean, we really thought we were heading into a recession. And then as a result of the pig crisis, money came out of Europe and came flooding into the U.S., driving down long-term interest rates, even at a time when the government lost its AAA rating. And then, of course, in 2012, the Fed jump-started the economy when they started announcing QE3 and QE4. And so the economy picked up steam. It began to pick up in 2012, 2013, and it was also going in 2014. Now what happens is the Fed withdraws that liquidity. And there's two things that I think really stand out here. From that point forward, John, we haven't hit, other than one quarter, in the last quarter of 2014, it was amazing. The quantitative easing ended in November. The fourth quarter of 2014, we barely hit 2% economic growth rate. John, and outside of the second quarter of last year, we've been below 2% growth rates, which is rather amazing, because you've got the Fed still projecting that the economy is going to grow at 2.4% in 2016. So the Fed is still behind the ball. In other words, in order for us to hit the Fed's growth rate this year, we're going to have to see the economy grow at a rate of 2.8% every single quarter. And I'm talking about the second, third, and fourth quarter. And that has not been the pattern. There's been a declining pattern since the second quarter of last year, where we got one big bump, and it's been a decline ever since then. Now, we may pick up a little bit in the second quarter, but not by much. But the current trend in GDP, John, is definitely in stall speed, which is so surprising that we still see the Fed hung up on raising interest rates. Like, these guys still don't get it. Or in the past, prior to an election, especially in 2012, they goosed the economy with QE3. Now they're not talking about that. So there are a number of members at the Fed, even though they're saying, okay, we're going to watch the numbers. But you know what? When you keep the market guessing that you're still trying to raise interest rates, you're creating a lot of uncertainty. And we'll get into the weeds here in just a minute. But you're definitely seeing this economy start to descend. And you're a pilot. And there's just not enough economic momentum here to carry this forward. And we're starting to get to that stall speed. So the Fed has got to be very, very careful here.
I think if we look back over the last few years here, Jim, what we've really seen, and I know this isn't the first time we've discussed this, that even at the time when the Fed was printing money, remember in the economy, we got fits and starts. It didn't just jump into action. A lot of times the first quarters of various years were in negative territory. And so what you're seeing here is that this is being driven more by monetary policy and not by fiscal policy, because the Obama stimuli just turned out to be a real flop. They didn't have any effect.
They had an effect for about 1 year, John, but most of it was transfer payments. And the problem with transfer payments, once you give somebody a transfer payment, you have to keep doing that. Otherwise, you don't get any continued effect. And that's the problem. There were supposed to be all these shovel-ready projects, and there weren't. So there is talk, and I would be very surprised if the next president, whether it's he or she, now that we know who the two candidates are, if fiscal policy is going to be it, because we're running to the end of the limits of monetary policy. And a good example of this is negative interest rates in Japan, where Japan's central bank has yet to admit its failure, but it had the opposite effect. Instead of spending the money, taking the money out of the bank, Japanese consumers basically bought safes. They're sticking the money in mattresses, or they're sticking it in safes rather than going out and spending money. It's hurting the banking industry, and it's having the opposite effect. So already, Japan's premier is basically said, you know, we're going to hold off on that tax hike. I don't think it's a good idea. So, but you're right. What's interesting is when you take a look at the last quarter of quantitative easing, which ended November 2014, that's when economic growth peaked, and that's when the stock market peaked. So, John, we have basically been in a decline in terms of economic growth since the stopping of QE, and the stock market has been going nowhere almost a year and a half now.
All right, if the Fed's not printing money now, which we're stipulating that it isn't, how much of what we're seeing was actually previously masked by the Fed's policy? In other words, now that the Fed's not there, how much of it is due to high taxes, high regulation there, and especially the consequences of Obamacare that have been really masked so far since the program came into existence to where we are? We all know the program's not sustainable the way it's set up. So it's just a question. But all of that, how much of that is manifesting in what we see today?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with it. I mean, there was a special report out this week in terms of called Regulation Nation. We've had so many regulations, it's estimated it costs the average consumer about $15,000 in various costs that impact the marketplace, from construction costs, housing costs, to utility costs, to medical costs. All of these regulations go into the cost of doing business. But, I mean, it was hidden, John, when the Fed was feeding the markets. I mean, at one time, they were feeding, what, $70, $80 billion a month into the market, and that could fuel asset prices. And, of course, as asset prices go up, you know, there's a knockoff effect with spending. And you're seeing this in the housing, where it's called the tale of two markets, where houses on the low end are doing very well because of the employment rate, because of, you know, the savings on gasoline and the lowest mortgage rates in, you know, recorded history right now. And that's helping on the low end. On the high end, people with money, given what's happened to the stock market, as I mentioned, it's gone nowhere in virtually a year and a half. On top of that, lower economic growth. And then you've got candidates from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders saying that, you know, I'm elected, your tax rates are going to go up even further. So I think also there's two elements of uncertainty here that are affecting the markets and affecting people that have money. And that is higher taxation may be coming depending on the outcome of the election. And then also the uncertainty of what the Fed's going to do. You know, they're on again, they're off again. Right now, we're following the same pattern that we did last year when we were talking the first part of the year, the Fed was going to raise in June. What did we do this year? We're starting, but the Fed's going to raise in June. Now the probability of a June rate hike has been lowered to about 15%. They're saying maybe September. And I suspect, John, with the economic numbers that we're seeing right now, as we get closer to that election, there's probably good reason why Obama called Janet Yellen to the White House with these kind of economic numbers. No party wants to go into a fall election with a bear market and a declining economy. But right now, we're seeing the impact of all these bad fiscal policies because we no longer have monetary stimulus in the way that we had from 2009 all the way to 2014 when the economy did much better. Obviously, when the Fed is printing $1 trillion or more a year and injecting that into the system, or, for example, in the year 2009, when the government injected $1 trillion of fiscal stimulus, that had an impact on the economy. But now, the ill effects of higher medical costs, more regulation, and higher taxes are really starting to impact the economy, and it's clearly seen in this trend with the economic numbers and the stock market numbers with the ending of QE in November of 2014.
Okay, so if it's not the Fed, and we've already included here bad fiscal policy, anything else that's actually pulling the market down as you can see it?
Well, I don't necessarily say pulling the market down, but certainly weighing down on the economy is the end of the debt super cycle. There's just simply too much debt. And even though asset prices have risen, consumer debt has come down, it's still well above historical norms. I mean, we were at debt to income ratios of 1.4%. We're down to a little over 1% right now. Consumer debt has come down in relation to assets, but corporations are loaded with debt and personal debt. And besides that, corporations are not investing. Small businesses are bogged down by taxation and regulation. And on top of that, John, you don't want companies doing what they did in China, where they're going out and building stuff to spend money and build stuff to create jobs. You've heard all those stories about see-through buildings, see-through cities, where they build all these buildings, nobody's living in them or occupying them. The last thing you want as a shareholder is a company to go out and spend money, build a new plant, build excess capacity when we do have excess capacity right now in manufacturing globally. So companies aren't investing either. So business investment has been very shallow in this economic recovery. Now, every single year, the economists project, at least when profits were rising, that companies would spend the money. They did not do that. The reason was there wasn't the demand to justify the spending. So what they were doing was financial engineering. They were buying back stock and raising dividends because they could not find a productive use of building new plants because there just wasn't the demand to justify that. So you have that. On one side, you've got too much consumer debt. And then, you know, on the other thing, too, is you have baby boomers who are heading into retirement or close to retirement, have gone through two bear markets. They don't have the assets that they thought they would have at retirement. They don't have the defined benefit pension plans that their parents had. So all they have is what they've saved. They haven't saved enough because in the 90s, they spent money. They didn't save because, I mean, why would you want to save when the stock market was going up 15 to 20% a year and you were told that was going to continue forever? So you are seeing boomers now starting to save more. The savings rate, which got down to zero, has actually been going up. And that's one thing that has surprised economists with all these savings that we've seen come from, let's say, the savings on gasoline. Consumers aren't spending it. They're saving. The actual savings rate is up to 5.4%. So contrary to what the economists and the Fed have been projecting, consumers have been more in a savings and cautionary mode, trying to work down debt, build up savings. So that's why you've seen a lot of weakness on the retail side at stores. You know, they're spending for services that are necessary, but that's why you have a weakness there. And 70% of the U.S. economy is basically services. And that was the one positive economic report we got, is the ISM service index ticked up a notch in this latest reading, while manufacturing ticked down a notch.
Well, Jim, all of this aside, we can talk about monetary policy and that's down, and then the fiscal policy didn't work. But even if we equalized all of that, I would say we still haven't seen economic growth rates coming out of the recession this time, which we've seen before. So that means something else is different in the mechanics.
First of all, I mean, just numbers wise, the U.S. is a much larger economy today. So the larger the economy, it's harder to grow at, let's say, higher rates. I mean, in the 50s, coming out of a recession, the economy grew between 7 and 8% a year. But typically, John, you've seen 4 to 5% growth rates has been somewhat the norm. It slowed down to a little over 3.6%. And then in the last decade, it was close to 3% under Bush. Since this recovery, we've averaged roughly about 2.1%. So it's basically been a very low economic growth. And John, once again, I think a big factor in this has been too much debt at the consumer. When you have 70% of your economy based on consumption and the consumer is heavily laden with debt, you're just not going to get the same amount of spending that was driven by credit as you have in previous decades. And this is the whole thesis that the folks at the bank credit analysts are talking about with their debt supercycle, because in every single recession, we never had the adjustment period, and each economic cycle was driven by higher and higher levels of debt, which really doubled in the last decade, which is one of the reasons we're having slow economic growth now, because a lot of that debt has to work out. My friend Gary Schilling, in his latest insight, when he wrote about his book that talked about what happened in this economic recovery, the slow growth period, he talks about this deleveraging could take another 6 to 7 years. And it's not just here. It's global, because we're seeing slow growth rates around the globe. In fact, one of Schilling's premises is that the increase of globalization has come to an end, because basically every factory that's been able to be shipped overseas is shipped overseas. So there's no more stronger growth rates coming to the emerging world. So it's not just here, John. It's also slower growth rates in the rest of the world. However, this slow growth rate explains why typically when you come out of a recession, usually with stronger growth rates, you get back to the previous peak within 2 to 3 years. In this economic recovery, because we've been only growing at 2% at times as now and in previous quarters, we've grown at less than 2. It has taken 7 years in this economic recovery to reach the prior peak. And that, once again, points to this anemic growth rate. And it's a combination of not only too much debt, but very poor fiscal policy.
All right, if we swing the focus here back to the economy, Jim, then continue making the case. What are the things making it look more and more likely that we're headed down into a recession, which, of course, means a change in plans for investors?
Number one, as we've been talking about, manufacturing, which is ticking down again. We got a brief upward tick, but the ISM manufacturing report now, even though manufacturing is a smaller portion of the U.S. economy today, at one point after World War II, it was almost a third of the U.S. economy. Today, it represents roughly about 12%. But John, it's not just manufacturing. It's all the off jobs that, you know, it's not just a company that makes things. It's all the services that go along with manufacturing. So the ISM manufacturing report ticked down again. It was below 50, meaning it was contracting, and it's been that way for almost 6 months. It ticked up in the month of March above 50, which means it's expanding. It just fell down to 50.8. More importantly, new orders also fell, because that tells you kind of like what's coming down the road. You've got inventories building, so that is not looking good. The other thing that we've seen, and this will tie into what we're seeing, is construction spending has also been trending lower right around about the time of last year, but the middle of last year in the second quarter, which was where we got that big pop in GDP. That was also the big pop that we saw in construction spending. It has been slowing ever since. And actually, we've had 3 negative months. The month of September was negative. The month of November was negative. And January was negative. And once again, John, we're starting to slow down. So that does not bode well. And here's the one that probably concerns us more than anything else. And it's probably what we call the tale of two cities. And that is the United States Senior Loan Officer survey. And it's showing a trend now that banks are beginning to tighten credit to businesses. So commercial industrial loans are pulling back, commercial real estate loans, they're pulling back. The only place that banks are being a little bit more aggressive is with consumers. You can see them now, you probably see in the commercials. Once again, banks are pushing no-doc loans. They don't call them that anymore. They're also, because we've seen appreciation in real estate prices, they're pushing home equity loans. But there's a contrast between tightening standards that we're seeing, let's say, on the institutional side, the commercial industrial side, and loosening standards that we're seeing on the consumer side. So banks are looking at the economy and saying, things don't look good for business. Earnings are contracting, so banks are getting more cautionary in their lending stance, not to mention the fact they've lost money in the energy sector. And they're seeing these economic numbers weaken. The consumer is holding up. But on the corporate profit side, they're seeing profits decline, so banks are starting to tighten lending standards. And of course, whenever you do that, you take a look at the cost of funds are starting to rise again. We could see that happen in the months ahead, as they did last fall when we saw credit spreads on corporate bonds begin to widen. And John, you know, even companies like Exxon just got its AAA rating yanked, and they've been downgraded a notch down to double B, which means Exxon is going to have to pay more money for raising debt. So I would say out of all the things that are more serious right now is the tightening of lending standards by banks. And that is sort of a harbinger of what we may begin to see further going into the latter part of this year and into next year.
Well, if we're assuming that the consumer is still holding up right now, anything else that we could say is propping up the economy so far?
Oh, sure. Our political critters are spending money. The budget deal that they busted last November, which is a lot of conservatives are very upset with Paul Ryan that he signed that budget deal because it busted all the spending caps. So the government budget deficit this year will be over $600 billion. So the government is going to be spending a lot of money, $200 billion more this year, and a lot of that will be spent closer as we get to the summer and closer to the election. Because, I mean, face it, if you're a politician and you don't want a bear market in stocks or a declining economy or a rising unemployment rate when it comes to elections, so government spending is still picking up, and that's going to add maybe $200 billion of stimulus to the economy. And a lot of that is also coming not just from the federal government, it's also coming from state governments. But right now, John, we're showing in about 23 states now, out of 50, we're showing rising unemployment. So even though the unemployment number nationally is ticked up a little bit, 23 states now, we're beginning to see a trend of rising unemployment.
Well, Jim, this is an election year. Of course, it's silly season. And one piece of rhetoric that we're hearing on a regular basis is that, you know, businesses are to be bashed and capitalism is bad. And, you know, you hear the whole thing. But in reality, the economy, if we look at it and we look at what businesses are doing in terms of their reported earnings this year, they're not doing exactly terrifically great either.
No, in fact, we've got four quarters of contracting earnings, and year over year, as of the first quarter of this year, earnings are down 7%. And we know what happens. There's a couple of things that this ties into. We're seeing that reflected in the employment numbers as corporations pull back on temporary hiring. The work week is being shortening because what's happening? Sales aren't growing. Companies are starting to, their profit margins are starting to be squeezed. And that's leading also to what we're seeing on the bank lending side. Banks are looking at these economic numbers. They're looking at the quarterly reports. They're seeing a downtrend in earnings. So banks are tightening lending as well. So all of these are starting to tighten together. And it's not just here, John. It's across the globe. We're seeing it in Europe. We're seeing it in Japan. So it's global. Now, it's not a real sharp contraction like we saw, let's say, in 2007, 2008, and 2009. But nonetheless, earnings are starting to contract. And what that signifies is eventually, within a period of time, and we always saw it, I think it was last week where Intel announced they're laying off 12,000 workers. They're starting to close more retail stores now. And that's a reflection of also online buying. So there are a number of things that are happening together. But once again, if you start connecting the little dots, you can see how all this is starting to fit into place. A profit recession first, And then eventually that should translate into, let's say, an economic recession. I don't think it's going to be a major one, but we're starting to see payrolls decline. We're starting to see business inventories start to pick up. And more importantly, when we talk about aggregate numbers, as we do with GDP or some of these regional numbers, what we like to follow is the Philly Fed survey of 50 states. Take a look at which states are starting to contract, which states are starting to experience weak economic results, which states are experiencing rising unemployment. And as the number of states begin to turn red, more and more states are turning red, that's also a trend we're also starting to follow as well. Also, we're seeing waning activity in mergers and acquisition. That reflects that rising credit spreads. It's getting more expensive to do a deal now. Banks are tightening credit, which means they're not only tightening it, but they're also raising the cost of that credit, which means it gets more expensive to do an acquisition.
Well, overall then, I think, we're probably not in a recession this year, but we're certainly moving towards it. And it most likely would emerge, sometime next year? Is that the time frame?
Yeah, I mean, if the Fed continues to do what it's doing, and also the political uncertainty that we have two uncertainties. And remember, the stock market doesn't like uncertainty. Now, Tom Clune may be absolutely right, because we've had a pullback here. Things have gotten a little bit bearish, and what the market tends to do is surprise a lot of people. We've got the commercials going short on treasuries, and it is possible, John, that we could see a little bump here because of the result of a couple things. We've seen in the energy sector pick up along with the commodities, but that has some negative effect when it comes to margins for companies down the road, which means it's going to cost more to make stuff, so margins could compress even further as we get later on into the fall. But we've had a downward trend here, but we've had the dollar fall since February, and it's pulled back a bit. That's helped a little bit on the export side. It's helped on the emerging market side. So we could see a little bit of a bump here in the second quarter. It's questionable how big that bump will be. In other words, are we going to get back up to over 2%? I just don't think so, unless something surprisingly happens in the month of June, but we just haven't seen it in the month of April, and we're not seeing it so far in the month of May. So we still have 6 weeks to go before this quarter ends. But the dollar has been slumping, and a lot of that reflects higher economic growth in Europe. It's picking up Chinese economic growth. They're stimulating their economy by spending a lot of money on infrastructure and also loosening credit standards. So China's doing what it's typically done, because it really hasn't made that transition yet to, let's say, a consumer-based economy.
Then you have to bring yourself down to a question. Here we are again this year, 2016. Looking at a situation that's very, very similar to 2015, where we're discussing on an ongoing basis, month to month, what the Fed will and won't do. But the Fed has already backed down, cutting its proposed rate hikes in half. The economic growth numbers are down, but the Fed's still talking about raising interest rates. And so there's either a question of what do they see that we don't see, or are they still trying to, regardless of what the numbers say, force themselves some wiggle room against another downturn, say if this recession is coming, something along those lines? I guess the question is, what do they see that we don't see? Or is it that they just don't see it?
Quite honestly, I don't think they see it, because they've got to look at these economic numbers. I mean, folks, we're not the only ones that have access to this information. The problem is, a lot of these guys are academics. They deal in economic theories rather than reality. A lot of these people didn't come from the private sector where they actually had a job, balance a payroll, meet a payroll. So a lot of this is just theoretical stuff to them. And you look at the numbers. I don't care if it's economic growth, what's happening to corporate earnings, what's happening to stock prices, all of that. You got to look at that and say, there's a story that's being told here. And gosh, if we can pick up on it, you know, guys with PhDs certainly ought to be able to do it as well. And they don't realize, by keeping the market guessing all the time as they're doing, will they or will they not? How many 180s have they done, John, over the last couple of years? They've done more in the last 2 years. We started out last year, it took them a whole year to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. And here we are, we'll probably go 9 months, and maybe even questionable. Maybe they don't raise. I mean, the markets say they don't go at all, or if anything, they only do one rate hike this year. And I think they're going to be really surprised. I think the Fed was overall surprised at the beginning of the year when they raised rates last December, a quarter of a point, at the reaction in the market. They didn't realize the combination of a rising dollar, what it was doing to profits in manufacturing and to exports. Also, the tightening credit spreads, what that was doing. So, you know, a lot of times they just don't have the market savvy, street savvy, or private sector experience to really put these things together. And they kind of huddle in a room, all PhDs, most of them coming out of universities. And they're looking at economic theory, John, rather than the real world.
So overall, I guess we look at what I call the so what. There's no recession this year. It's really clear we're not going to hit the Fed's growth targets. That's really clear. That means we're operating at stalling speeds. You know, we used to call it, when you did some exercise, hanging on the ragged edge of a stall. And one shock in the wrong direction puts you right into a recession. So that's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one good thing about when the economy is growing. It's like a shock absorber. It can absorb a lot of the bad things that can happen to it. A good example was the way the economy responded to all the series of shocks that we got in 2011. We had Fukushima, we had the Arab Spring, we had spike in oil prices, we had the pig crisis, the debt ceiling crisis. But, you know, we were coming off 4% growth rates in the economy. And plus, well, the Fed was also injecting, in 2011, they injected roughly about $600 billion into the economy with their monetary stimulus. But that's the good thing about economic growth rates. When the economy is growing, you can absorb a shock. When you're in stall speed, and John, you're a pilot, what happens, you know, you can probably use an analogy here for our listeners. What happens when you're in a stall speed as an airplane? What do you need to do?
Put the nose down. Nose down, more power, but you don't have a lot of wiggle room. In other words, there's no extra maneuvering because creating extra weight by centrifugal force or anything makes the plane heavier and throws you right into a stall. But mostly you put the nose down.
They definitely need to do something here because we are in stall speed. So, you know, some exogenous shock that nobody can see right now could have a major impact on the economy, because when you're only growing at a growth rate of 0.5%, that is not a lot of cushion to absorb any shock.
And as always, Jim, what we're going to do, because I love the so what question at the end of any discourse, what is this going to mean to investors? Funny you should ask that question. We'll answer it in the next part of The Big Picture coming up next as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Carl Riccadonna. He's chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg Intelligence. And Carl, last week we saw the first quarter GDP estimate come out at 0.5%, so quite low. That could be revised up or down when the second estimate comes out later this month. But in the past, we've seen the first quarter typically weak. I think for the past 10 or so years, we've seen the first quarter average weaker than other quarters. And a lot of analysts have said that it's due to seasonality effects or weather. You know, at one point there was the port strike. So there's always these reasons that are cited for why we see first quarter weakness. That being said, do you think that we can dismiss this weakness again that we saw in the first quarter for U.S. GDP growth as an anomaly? Or do you think that there are some signs that we're looking at the underlying momentum of the U.S. economy starting to slow?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't think we can entirely dismiss it, but we certainly do need to place an asterisk next to that result. Now, as you highlighted, we have seen this pattern of Q1 weakness, and in 8 of the last 10 years, the first quarter growth figure was lower than the average over the 4 quarters of the year. So there does seem to be what the economists call residual seasonality. Now, that being said, that tells us don't worry too much about the weak Q1 number, but we are seeing a deceleration in the pace of economic growth. So if we go back to Q2 of last year, the economy grew 3.9%. Q3 Q3, we decelerated to 2%. Q4 of last year, 1.4%. And then, as you highlighted, 0.5% in the first quarter of this year. So there's a longer deceleration that we have to be cognizant of. And this is a result of many factors. Maybe there's some seasonality at play. Also, the currency has impacted things. The decline in commodity and energy prices in particular has taken a toll. And the financial market volatility that we saw both late last summer as well as at the start of this year have extracted a toll. So the economy has slowed, maybe not quite as much as what that Q1 number suggests.
Seven years ago, in April of 2009, our economy lost nearly 700,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate hit 9% on its way to 10%. 7 years later, in April 2016, our economy added 160,000 new jobs. That makes April the 74th consecutive month of private sector job growth in America. Over that record streak of job growth, our businesses have created 14.6 million new jobs in all. Wages have been rising at an annual rate of more than 3% this year. So the unemployment rate has been growing, unemployment has been falling, and wages have been rising. But the global economy, as many people here are aware, is not growing as fast as it should be. You're still seeing lagging growth in places like Europe, Japan, and now China. Here in the United States, there are folks out there who are still hurting. And so we've got to do everything we can to strengthen the good trends and to guard against some dangerous trends in the global economy.
There was our president, President Obama, taking to the podium on Friday to address some of the nasty numbers which came out on Friday. Jobs numbers came out, not looking good. Jobs created is steadily falling. Unemployment ticked up to 5%. And one of the things that didn't get too much notice is the fact that the earlier jobs numbers, Jim, have been revised downwards. And this is a little trick that's played by having better jobs numbers when everybody's looking and the media all reports it. And later on, they revise them downwards when nobody seems to notice or bothers to report on it. President Obama was saying we aren't using enough government money to create jobs. But if we look backwards, his stimulus didn't work before to get this whole thing going. By the way, have you noticed, Jim, they're talking about infrastructure now. Remember when Franklin Delano Roosevelt, at least during his New Deal, was trying to provide stimulus, but at least it went into assets that some of which we have actually with us today as being functional, whereas that's not what happened during President Obama's stimulus plan. And with the national debt closing in on $20 trillion, there really isn't much stomach for more of that. It's amazing during all of this election time to see these people promising things, and you're going to pay for this. How? What were you talking about that? So, you know, a lot of people on the street, Jim, are not feeling the so-called recovery. And that's been one hallmark of this recovery, is that, well, to a certain degree, there's been a recovery in the markets and some of the economics. The person on the street isn't feeling it in the job. So the real question is, given all of this, why have we seen such a rally in the market?
Well, I mean, we're back to ground zero again, John. You remember at the beginning of the year, the Fed had just come off raising interest rates. Finally, at the end of the year, they raised it a quarter of a point. They were projecting 4 rate hikes. In the very first day of trading, I mean, the market went down every single week until we got into the middle of February. Now, what were the markets worried about? Well, number one, they were worried about the coming Fed rate hikes, especially with the economy decelerating. It was kind of like, what are you guys going to do? So we were worried about Fed rate hikes. The dollar was rallying. It was hurting exports, hurting profit margins at the S&P 500 companies. We had commodity prices falling to record lows. Remember, gold got down below $1,100. Oil prices got down to $26. We had falling commodity prices. And with the rising dollar, that was also impacting emerging markets. And the IMF, the World Bank, all of the major agencies were downgrading economic growth, even though the Fed when it came out with its December forecast, was still looking at 2.4% economic growth, which would be a miracle if they achieved that now, given what we've seen with the economic numbers. So all of that was what was weighing on the markets. And that's why we got the markets down roughly about 10-12%. And some of the markets, like emerging markets, were down even more. And if you're looking at commodities, we had double-digit losses in commodities from oil to even precious metals at that time. So all of this was what we were worried about at the beginning of the year. So that accounted for what we saw take place from January all the way to the middle of February.
Yeah, but if you look this week, Jim, there's been a radical change. Everything's going up from commodities to stocks to, well, you name it. What changed, at least in the psychology?
Well, I mean, since the middle of February, I think what changed was the Fed going out. First of all, they had their January FOMC meeting, which was a little dovish. But afterwards, we had Janet Yellen up on Capitol Hill, and all of a sudden, you were beginning to hear a dovish Fed. So with the dovish Fed, especially with not only negative interest rates in Japan, which was launched in February, but also Janet Yellen's testimony, all of a sudden we went from, boy, we're going to raise interest rates a quarter of a point, to all of a sudden the Fed was beginning to sound more dovish, which was followed up, John, in the March FOMC meeting when the Fed released its first preliminary forecast for the year. And everything got reduced. The economic growth rate got reduced. The dot plot, the number of rate hikes, got cut in half. And all of that started, and what that did is change psychology. The dollar began to fall. As the dollar began to fall, we had a lot of relief going to emerging market. And all of a sudden, there was a big short covering rally, and it was back to from risk off. We went to the risk on rally, which continued for 10 weeks. This is the first down week. We didn't quite make it to 11 weeks of positive gains in the market, but it was sort of all of a sudden, okay, we can breathe a sigh of relief. The Fed is not going to be as tough as it said it was going to be in December. And, you know, the markets like easy credit. And besides, with weak economic numbers, both overseas and here, as demonstrated by today's unemployment report, where jobs created was fallen down to 160,000. So we've gone from the high 200s. Now we're below 200. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the market was saying that with weak economic data, okay, maybe the Fed is finally getting some sense into its head and not tightening. And that, I think, John, was the big reversal that we saw in why it was so steep. Is a lot of short positions. I don't care if you're looking at short positions in commodities to short positions in stocks. All of that got reversed, which explained this big, big relief rally that we saw coming out of those February lows.
Well, this is a pretty predictable pattern because, and I'll show you what I mean in a second. If we look after President Obama's talk that was carried on Friday, the financial channels pointed out the fact that the national debt has doubled. And remember, when you get into sort of this end game on currency, things begin to proceed in a logarithmic fashion. They go up faster than they did before. The fiscal policy has flopped. And so now that we're here, rather than doing something that might work, we start the blame game. But isn't that how it always is? You know, politicians will always find some reason for why their plans have failed. And the reason is not them.
No, it's always the opposition party or something, or in the president's speech on Friday, we need to spend more money. In one sense, I agree with him. But it's a question of how that policy, fiscal policy, is delivered. And the best way to spend money is to lower taxes, especially on small businesses, the job creators. And I suspect whoever the president is going to be next year, whether it be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you're going to see fiscal spending coming out of Washington, and it's going to be a helicopter drop. They will want to put money in consumers' wallets. And one of the best ways to do that is cut taxes, allowing people to keep more of their pay. They did that. George Bush did it very successfully in 2003. It was done again, but it was temporary in 2010 when they cut the payroll tax. But here's something that politicians don't understand, which markets do and businesses do. It doesn't work when it's only temporary. In other words, if the government says, look, I'm going to give you a tax break, but we're only going to allow it for a year, what ended up happening is people increased their savings. So in order for something to become effective, it's got to be somewhat permanent, because if you're a business and the government says, look, we're going to give you a tax break, but the tax break is only good for 1 year. What are you going to do? You're not going to do anything, because you're going to say, hey, this is only good for a year. I'm not going to go out and build a new plant or buy a whole bunch of equipment. You may buy some, but you still have that uncertainty. And this is one of the things that people in government don't understand, whether it's the Federal Reserve, which is basically saying, well, we're still in that raising interest rate move, but we're data dependent. Well, what does that do? It creates uncertainty for investors in the marketplace, because you don't know what they're going to do. You don't know if they're going to flip-flop. You don't know if things improve, they'll say start getting hawkish again. And the same thing happens with government policy. Whenever you tell somebody it's only going to be temporary, you're not going to take action on it. And that's something government, whether it's politicians or Federal Reserve chairman or governors, they simply don't understand that. And that's why markets react the way they do. And as we pointed out in the first segment, you take the end of quantitative easing, which ended in November of 2014, the markets have gone sideways. They've gone nowhere. And the economy peaked. And so now, as we get closer and closer to the election, all of a sudden the White House and politicians are starting to get nervous, because things are beginning to slow down, as we pointed out in the first hour, in the first part of this big picture segment, and things are slowing down, and it's being reflected in this unemployment number.
You know, and I know, Jim, this is not a surprise for listeners here, because I know you've been pointing out for the last couple of months that the hours worked in temporary employment, those numbers are falling. And that tends to be a precursor of a bigger storm that follows, which is what the numbers we are seeing now are.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we saw, as you mentioned, John. It wasn't just the fact that the employment, the number of jobs has come down, but the previous months were revised down dramatically. So at first, when the jobs numbers came out at the beginning of the year, they were sounding pretty good, which was why that hawkish stance from the Fed was worrying the market, because unemployment numbers, the big job numbers were coming out, and they go, well, they're going to be raising interest rates. Well, turns out the January numbers weren't as high as they thought. They've been revised down to only 168,000 jobs. February and March were revised down to 233 and 208. And then, of course, the numbers that we got today were revised, the initial numbers, 160, and that may even be going lower. So it's not very good. And we continue to lose jobs in the goods-producing sectors. Some of the jobs created were in services. Average hourly earnings for all employees ticked up just a notch. The average work week, roughly about the same. So all these things are starting to, like I say, it's sort of little nuanced little things that happen, whether it's the drop of temporary workers or it's the drop in the hourly work week, which has gone from roughly about 35 down to 34 and a half. And so those kind of things, John, reflect what we're seeing now. The number of jobs being created are dropping and falling. They've been doing that since probably last fall. And then also we're starting to see, like as we announced last week, Intel's laying off 12,000 workers. And you're now starting to see some of the bigger retail stores like Walmart's closing some stores. So these are the kind of things that you see at the beginning of a downturn when the economy has peaked. And that's what's starting to play out right now. And that's got the White House very worried about this upcoming election when we come to November, what the employment picture is going to be looking and what the economy is going to be looking at. Now, we'll talk about here in a minute. We're going to get a brief reprieve here, probably in the second quarter. Whether that will carry over into the third quarter is questionable.
You know, Jim, but you have to keep bouncing back to this ultimate question, which seems to be the big gorilla in the room. The problem isn't just fiscal policy. Sooner or later, there's this collective consciousness out there that there's a huge amount of debt. I'm not just talking about our government debt, but there's corporate and private debt as well.
Yeah, and that's been sort of a restraint on consumers and now on corporations in terms of capital investment. And consumers have been paring down debt. And the good news, I guess, is consumers are starting to repair their balance sheets. But the savings rate keeps climbing, John. So all those savings that were supposed to take place from lower gasoline prices, consumers have been banking and building up their savings because there is, once again, a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to government policy. There's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to what the Fed's going to do. And so people instinctively know. In fact, if you take a look at the real job numbers in terms of the number of people that just don't want to work or don't think they can find jobs, the unemployment rate would be much, much higher. According to my friend Gary Schilling today, the true unemployment rate is probably closer to 13%. And that's why you see this angst that you have out there with the voting public. And, you know, people are just saying, you know, a lot of the blow dries on TV are just saying, well, you know, the voters are just having a tizzy fit. Well, no, the voters in both parties are gravitating to the non-establishment candidates, whether it's Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side or Donald Trump on the Republican side, because they're saying Washington has made a mess of everything. Things aren't working. And we need somebody, an outsider, that's going to fix it because, you know, the pros in Washington are probably more interested in keeping their own jobs than they are than creating jobs.
Yeah, what's really interesting, Jim, is I started to read some of the op-ed pieces on why this fascination in the United States with, say, Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. And what always amuses me is they write, it's like they're talking to each other. Well, we think the people are this. We think the people are that. And my thought is constantly, why don't you go ask the people and they'll tell you what they think? You know, they do.
Yeah, I know. Instead of pontificating.
Instead of pontificating on it. But the real issue that we're facing right here is that the drivers that we have seen on the international economy, you know, in terms of globalization, that era is coming to an end as well. I mean, there's excess capacity in manufacturing and excess capacity in commodities, and global debt is not terrific either.
No, I mean, you take a look at, there is a glut of excess capacity. I don't care if you're getting into natural resources, which we've seen reflected in oil prices with American fracking coming online. All of a sudden, 4 or 5 million barrels of new oil production came online, and all of a sudden, oil prices have weakened, and we just don't have the economic growth rates that we had in the last decade. And John, you know, you take a look at the era of globalization, which took place between, let's say, the 80s and the beginning of the last decade. All the jobs and factories that have been outsourced have been outsourced. And if you look at some of the trends, a lot of companies are bringing back factories here because of the cost of transportation, logistic problems. I mean, Apple's building its next factory. They're building that in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's going to be done. It's 2,000 workers, and it's going to be done with robotics. Tesla is going to be building a factory in Nevada. So the era of globalization is coming to an end, and China has huge, massive debt problems, infrastructure problems, see-through cities, excess capacity, and even though they're resorting to the same tactics again, they're loosening credit standards and they're spending a lot of government money on government projects. But John, that's the problem. You build something that isn't really needed, or you don't have a demand for it. It's something that government planning just really doesn't understand. So part of the problem is globalization, which was a big economic driver in the latter part of the 90s, in the last decade. What we're seeing now is, you know, if you take a look at Chinese economic growth, the official numbers are 6.5%. Those that we talk to who are actually overseas in China believe that the economic growth rate is probably half of that. In other words, China's economy is probably really only growing at about maybe 2 to 3%. So you don't have the second largest economy in the world expanding at that double-digit pace that we saw in the last decade, with tremendous demands for all kinds of manufactured goods. Companies were going there as they opened up and building factories. And China was a great resource and consumer of natural resources. They were consuming just about half of everything. I don't care, from iron ore to aluminum to everything else to steel. So right now, globalization has slowed down tremendously and is unlikely to increase. So what we have right now is a lack of a global driver.
Well, I know, Jim, you've often said here on the program, we have the best looking house in a global neighborhood. If we look across the ocean at some issues, I'm thinking especially like of China, their debt and capacity issues, how do we stack up now versus what's going on elsewhere?
I mean, we still look the best, and it's one of the reasons why interest rates have stayed in such a narrow range. I mean, 1/3 of sovereign debt in this world has a negative interest rate. So 1.75% may not sound like a high interest rate here in the United States, but when interest rates are negative overseas, I mean, you know, 1.75 almost looks like a junk bond. And the other thing is the U.S. is probably more self-sufficient in so many things, from commodities to manufacturing, than any other country. And even though the president has doubled the national debt, just like his predecessor before him, George W. Bush, who doubled the national debt, our debt levels are still low enough compared to our economy versus China's debt levels, which are almost 250%. You know, we're getting closer to 100% right now. So that makes us a little bit more immune. And the United States not only accounts for almost 25% of world GDP, but we also have the largest, most liquid market in the world. And that's very important. And that's why in times of stress or any time of safety concerns, the U.S. is a safe haven for the rest of the world. And that's why you see this demand for treasuries, which have kept interest rates here in the U.S. below 2%. I mean, it's hard to believe, John, that, you know, the 10-year treasury note, even despite some of the hawkish talk by the Fed over the last 2 years, we've been in a narrow trading range anywhere from 1.6 to 2%. So interest rates are actually lower now than when the Fed first started talking about raising interest rates. But, you know, one of the problems that we have, China has too much debt, has too much excess capacity. There's too much excess capacity in the commodity producing countries. There's a lack of a real economic driver in, quite honestly, fiscal policies from the U.S. all the way to Europe and Japan have just been terrible.
Well, I know Tom McClellan thinks that after this correction, we could see a nice run up in stocks. So what would drive that?
We're seeing a number of things. A lot of the things that happened that was weighing on the market in the first part of the year have been reduced. In other words, credit spreads have narrowed, especially in the junk bond space. They've come down from the high 8% level down into the 5% level. We've seen a slight uptick as a result of a falling dollar in some of the PMIs here. Really not that strong, but I would say probably the best thing is what we're seeing globally. I mean, 19 of the 28 global countries that we follow are above 50, meaning that their economies are expanding. 12 of the 28 actually improved in the month of April. So month over month, we're seeing an improvement. But, you know, once again, we've got a major issue coming up in June, the Brexit. You know, will Britain leave the European Union? So that's why in the futures market, the expectations for a June rate hike, John, this is a repeat of what we were talking about last year. It was going to be the first hike was going to come in June. Well, as we saw the dismal economic numbers in the first quarter, all of a sudden those numbers got backed off until September. And that's what's going on right now. This is almost a repeat of what we saw last year. There's only less than a 15% probability that the Fed will go in June. And I would say, so all the bets are on September. And given these weak economic numbers and election, it's doubtful whether the Fed's going to even go in September. I suspect if they go at all, it'll probably be in December. So right now, that's giving a temporary reprieve to the market. And if Tom McClellan is right, we get a correction here, then the risk on trade, the market rallied on this Friday on the lousy job numbers, because what is that telling? The market is saying, look, the job numbers really suck and things are worsening. So that means less of a probability that the Fed is probably going to be hiking rates in June. So the market is rallying off that.
So does that mean if McClellan's right, then we're back to risk on trade?
It certainly looks that way. We're seeing it on some of the numbers on Friday. The S&P, the NASDAQ is up. We've got all the major indexes up, commodity prices. Gold is almost up close to $18, and gold is sensing some of the same things that, you know, hey, the central bank is probably not going to end up raising interest rates, and gold is benefiting from negative interest rates around the globe. So risk on trade is on full. So we're probably going to get a temporary lift here in the LEIs for the next few months. And it looks more and more likely that the June rate hike is extremely remote at this point. It's very, very doubtful. And I would not be surprised if we start seeing the same thing about a September rate hike. They're just not going to want, with these kind of job numbers coming out. And remember, this is a trend. This is more of a longer-term trend that we're seeing now, and it is trending downward. when it comes to job creation. The unemployment rate is ticking up. Business inventories are picking up. All these kind of things are starting to happen, John. I doubt even if they're going to raise in September, especially Yellen being a staunch Democrat, if things are looking this weak a couple months prior to a presidential election.
Well, here's that question I always ask, given the environment and the fact that we may see an upturn in the market after this correction. What do you do?
You know what? We like short-term corporate bonds in the 1 to 2 year area. And we do think that as we get more or further weakness in the economy, especially as we head into the fall and towards the end of this year, what that will do is create widening credit spreads, very much like what happened last fall. So if you keep your, let's say, maturity short, you know, you can get 3 to 4%. You know, that certainly beats zero in cash. We also like high dividend paying stocks and industries that are immune from an economic downturn, everything from utilities to consumer staples. We like that. And we also, John, like precious metals. I wouldn't be chasing them right here because you could see some weakness here, seasonality come into play, as Tom McClellan talked about in the first hour. Probably a better period to wait for is some summer weakness for some buying to pick up on precious metals. But we're still playing that defensive position with 40% in bonds, arbitrage on corporate takeovers for cash, and we like precious metals and some cash here. So even though this is temporary, I really wouldn't be chasing things. I mean, stocks, folks, are not cheap, and you really need to look at what you're buying here and do it selectively and wait for opportunities like we've gotten here with this pullback recently to pick those stocks that more in character that are going to offer you a rate of return in the way of dividends, current dividends, dividends that can increase over time because those companies hold up better because investors know that they're going to get a higher return with dividend increases, and preferably in some kind of industry that is less immune to an economic downturn. You don't want to be in very cyclical oriented companies with these weakening economic numbers that we've gotten, even though we might get a temporary reprieve here in the short term. But I just don't see anything here that is really going to revitalize this economy. You know, we've got a temporary reprieve here, and that's all I think it's going to be.
You know, and the interesting thing, Jim, is that economies, historically, we know that economies and what people are feeling in their pocketbooks and the things they're struggling with at home, those things tend to determine elections more than anything else. And the question is, how much prop up is going to be accomplished between now and November? So we'll see what's going to be. Anyway, weeks that are coming up here on the program, what are we looking for?
You know, watch these economic numbers, because now we've got a definitive trend here with a slowdown in the job numbers. Watch those LAIs. We're just about finishing up here the tail end of corporate earnings season. So what I would look for is what economic numbers are going to tell us, because that will confirm whether the Fed remains on hold in June. That should give us a nice little rally. And I just don't expect them to go in June anyway, because you got the Brexit. And the last thing the Fed wants to be doing is raising interest rates. I mean, the numbers that they're seeing in the employment trend has got to give these guys some pause when they look at these numbers and saying, oh my goodness, we were creating almost 290,000 jobs last fall. We're down to 160,000. We just revised lower all the previous months. I mean, these guys have got to be looking at that and say, what the heck are we doing? And so those are the things we're going to be watching on. But this is no time, folks, to be aggressive unless you're an astute trader with your investments. And in the coming weeks, look for some clues. Fed governors will be out in force speaking, so look for confirmation of those dovish trends. That was one of the things that sort of got the markets going when Yellen went on Capitol Hill in February, and then all the Fed governors all of a sudden start giving speeches and say, well, maybe we'll hold back. So look for more of that in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.